Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Before we get started, we are podcasting. If you are a multitasker, you can check out our website, themacguffinman.com. We have tons and tons of previous episodes that you can check out, most recently in Justice for All. Before that was Double Indemnity. Before that was Poltergeist. And then one about Dazed and Confused and Everybody Wants Some. A link later twofer. I've also written a handful of things recently about things such as Nathan For You and Lady Bird, so you can check those out if you like or don't. I don't really care all that much. So yeah, theme song, and then we'll start talking about our movie.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James,
yep.
Did you run across the room before during the theme song? What happened here?
I cleared my throat.
Okay, that's kind of you. Well, now that your throat is clear, can you tell us what we're talking about here today?
Yes, I can. We're talking about the Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Cool.
Yeah, it is cool.
Movies are cool. That's just my general review of the concept of cinema.
Yeah. This one, we're kind of getting out ahead in front of this one in some ways.
I mean, it just so happens that you were in the city that had it on opening day as it begins its platform release. So you were able to see it quicker than you're usually able to see these Oscar rollout sort of movies.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great for you, great for me.
Yeah, I just think it's a movie people will be hearing more and more about, obviously. And yeah, as you said, it wasn't opened wide. And we've kind of known this was coming since TIFF, where it got a very positive response. But I think we'll hear about it now, and then we'll hear about it, I'm guessing, around Oscar time once again.
Yeah, for sure. I find it hard to believe there's no Frances McDormand and or screenplay nomination for this movie.
And no Sam Rockwell?
I don't know. I don't know how Hollywood views Sam Rockwell, you know? Also, I don't think he would care at all. I don't think Frances McDormand would care either, but I think it's going to happen anyway, because she's got the pedigree, and she's Frances McDormand.
Yes.
So I don't know. I just don't know how Sam Rockwell is viewed by the Academy.
Okay. And yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how we're supposed to feel about his character in this one either.
Well, I mean, I think a big part of this movie and being able to follow through on this movie or follow any sort of emotional journey through this movie is the fact that despite watching Mildred Hayes, who's Frances McDormand's character, watching her throughout this movie, I think it's a difficult role because she doesn't do a ton of likable things. She does a lot of things in this movie that are unlikable, and I think we don't shut ourselves off from her because it's Frances McDormand, you know? And whatever little things Frances McDormand is doing, as well as just being somebody we have in our heads as I forget her character's name in Fargo, but that is who everybody sees Frances McDormand as.
Marge,
there you go. She's just so likable in that movie, and I think that just sort of carries through, even though we're now 21 years removed from Fargo. I think there's a warmth about Frances McDormand that really that she just has that allows you to be okay with her Molotov cocktailing a police station. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, that's the limit of it, and I mean, perhaps a little ridiculous even for this movie. But no, you're right. I mean, she does a lot of things that aren't likable, but. Fun to watch, I guess, is a way to put it. Her being kind of awful towards people, but in a way that is very entertaining because what she's saying is funny and how she's saying it is very funny. But I think you're right. I mean, I think that's kind of the crux of this movie, is that it's not right down the middle and you don't know what to make of it for large portions, I think. And I think when it comes to Mildred, I mean, some of the redemptive things about her is that as many awful things as she does, she's still a victim in a lot of ways, so you do want to sympathize with her. You know, she's a mother of a teenage daughter who was raped and murdered pretty horribly, even by rape and murder standards. And, you know, she goes through some terrible things in this. And so because she's the character that we see the most of, we sympathize with her just for that reason. But then, you know, she's mistreated by the dentist, by the police, by the media, by that man who comes into her store and is very physically threatening towards her. So that, I think, it lets us empathize with her, I guess is the proper word, pretty well. But you're right. I mean, she says some awful things and does some awful things. And yeah, the most extreme case, of course, being, you know, Molotov cocktails to a police station, which is just, it's so extreme. You know, she didn't know someone was in there, but just that's such a serious offense for so many reasons, for so many good reasons, I might add, that it does kind of make it tough. And I think that the way that this movie ends, with not even our two characters who are sort of in the gray between black and white by the end of this movie, by that I mean Dixon and Mildred, Dixon, who we're supposed to hate right away and then kind of slowly, I think, watch his redemption, and Mildred, who I think we just suffer with, but for the most part are supposed to come out liking, they're unsure about what to do. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how gray this movie is, that these characters aren't, it's the part of the script where they are doing this kind of, maybe not necessarily selfless act, but doing something kind of brave and for not financial benefit, but they're uncertain about it. And this movie just leaves you with this big question mark at the end. And I think that speaks to so much about what this movie is that it occupies all these very weird spaces in between, as do its characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a playwright staple, ending your movie on a question as opposed to an answer. And also a Martin McDonagh staple in that he is a playwright. But yeah, I agree. And it does bounce around a lot. I mean, part of the unlikability of Mildred, or potential unlikability of Mildred, comes in like minute 8 when Woody Harrelson's character, Willoughby, comes to see her after the billboards have been put up. And she basically looks him in the eye, and as he tells her that he has cancer, and she already knows. And she just says it wouldn't make much of a difference after you've croaked, I believe, is like some croaked is definitely the word she uses before that, I'm paraphrasing. But like, to look a man with pancreatic cancer in the eye and basically be fuck you to him, like, that's I don't know, that's a pretty, like, that's a deep line in the sand, you know, like, you're really digging in and going over that line a few times with that one, you know. And but we do get these small moments with Mildred throughout the movie. You never get a big emotional moment from her in sort of like a more positive, happy, loving sort of way. But, you know, like, really early, even earlier than that line drawing that I mentioned, when she goes in to get the billboards put up, you see that bug, that insect that's on its back, and she just sort of like flips it over. Just like that tiny little act of kindness, I think, does a lot in sort of showing a sort of warmth about Mildred. And same with later when Willoughby coughs blood in her face, and she just immediately is just like, I know this isn't, like, we're out of battle mode now, and now I'm just like, yeah, I'm taking care of you as a human being, just momentarily, you know, like those little moments. And when she throws Rice Krispies at her son, and her son is annoyed, but then like warms up a little bit, you know, like, you can just sort of see there's a layer of Mildred that it seems to be like, if we got to know her, like, you would know that she's a person that exists in a gray area, you know, like, she is a warm, loving person who is also kind of cold, you know. And even like, just the nature of Willoughby and Mildred's relationship is just combative, but in pretty much all of their scenes, it seems like they might, like, I don't know that they were hanging out together before Angela was murdered, but it definitely seems like they sort of get along. Like, they seem like the two most like compatible people friendship wise in this movie, outside of Mildred and the person that works in the store with her.
Denise.
Yeah. Like, it really seems like they kind of get along, you know, and it just so happens that this event has put them on exact opposite sides of each other.
Yeah, I get the sense that they were in the same circle in high school, but not necessarily super close, but like know enough about each other and get along. Well, you know, yeah. That's I have nothing to back that up. It's not part of the story, but I kind of see what the vibe you're talking about. And about her likability and Mildred's, and I'll start with her flipping that bug over. Yeah, there's some kindness there to her, and then I think that also gives away this idea that she is going to do something to right the world, at least in her opinion, right? Yeah, like she is a force that is going to be felt by the what happens around her, right? And you know, you can disagree or agree with the way she goes about it, and you know, it kind of seems like Willoughby has sort of done what it is he was supposed to do. I mean, sometimes it's just really hard to solve a crime, right? Like you don't get the sense that he was very flippant about it. You get the sense that maybe some other people in the police force aren't quite doing what they're supposed to be doing, obviously Dixon being the best example, but just this idea that she is going to impose her will on something, like things are going to be different as a result of her actions. And this movie is dominoes falling, you know what I mean? Like we're a few minutes into this movie when the three billboards get, you know, put up, or at least they get seen, and the idea gets planted in her head. So
I mean, the opening shot is the empty billboards, and then we just see Mildred getting her idea and then picking her teeth and then cutting to the title card, you know.
Yeah, we don't really ever get the sense of what this world is before this. You know, we don't get 20 minutes of establishing how this world functions, and then, you know, in screenwriting terms, the inciting incident that causes all these dominoes to fall. Like, the inciting incident is this crime, and, or, I don't know, maybe Mildred seeing empty billboards and just taking it upon herself, right? It all happens so quickly, but things happen in this movie, and things, like, it is, as I said, it's dominoes falling. So many things happen. It all starts with Mildred doing this one thing, flipping this one switch, getting this idea, and, you know, just like with this bug, writing, like putting it, literally writing it, putting it on its feet and allowing it to continue movement and to continue its life. And I think one of the really weird ways that we gain a bit more sympathy for her, and it's actually her doing something pretty awful, is when we have the flashback with her and when Angela's still alive, her daughter, and they're fighting over the car, and Angela says, "I hope I get raped," and she says, "I hope you get raped too." And you just get this sense that obviously she was just really mad, and she's not the kind of mother that would ever say that and mean that. I think there are probably very few mothers that would say that and mean that. But and they don't even lean on it too hard. Like, she kind of has this face where there's like the pain of regret of that being said, but it's really not dwelled on. It's not her, you know, crying alone for a few minutes. It's just, we just kind of move past it, but it's her doing something awful. But I think we understand that this is something she has probably thought about and ruminated over and regretted so hard in the past 7 months up until this point that it just brings us down to a moment where we've done something wrong or said something, you know, kind of flippantly and regretted it. And, you know, good people do bad things. And I think this is just one of those where it makes her, you know, a little bit rougher around the edges, but it really kind of does put a bit of a heart into her as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's also the only flashback in the movie, outside of a little bit after Willoughby dies, but like those flashbacks are to so little previous time. It's to like an hour before, but like,
oh yeah, yeah.
But you know, it's just the only moment in the movie where the McDonough decides that Mildred has thought about this enough that we have to actually show it. You know, like, this is something that clearly gnaws at her. We're not going to use flashbacks as a device throughout the movie, but we have to show just how deep the pain of that Mildred's going through with this one specific memory is, you know?
Yeah, you can imagine that that's something that, against her will, she has forced herself to dwell on for so long, right? Like, this is a constant flashback in her mental existence that McDonough kind of forces us, like drags us back into that place to experience that with her, as unpleasant as it is.
Yeah, exactly. And that type of, like, she's like sitting in her bedroom when that happens. But that's also exactly the type of flashback that happens when you're just like, she'd be walking into the store and it just sort of pops into her head. You know, like she's going to the police station or whatever, that pops into her head. She's going to the dentist, that pops into her head. But that's the time where she like is just sitting and dwelling and thinking about Angela. And of course it would pop into her head. You know, like that's just the type of thing that would never leave you. And certainly 7 months after the fact, it would just constantly be popping into your head.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Oh, completely. No. Yeah. And yeah, this is kind of a movie that, I mean, it's so much her movie, as big as Dixon and Willoughby are in this. It's clearly hers. And yeah, it is kind of meditative in that way, that you just kind of living with her and experience this story through hers. But as I said, like, so many things do happen in this movie, and I think that is part of what I loved about this movie so much, is the way that these dominoes fall, and it doesn't feel gimmicky or unrealistic, maybe with the exception of the Molotov cocktails, which I think is a little much, but is important to this movie. But no. I do
sorry, continue your point.
No, what are you going to say?
I was just going to say, like, the whole tone of the movie is unrealistic, you know? Like, just like anything where somebody just has a certain style of dialogue that they write in. Like, nobody in this movie talks like a real person, you know? So there's just this layer of unreality that exists. Just this thin layer of unreality, you know? And I just don't feel like I'm watching reality when I'm watching this movie, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah. And I read the a Vanity Fair review that talks about how this is kind of Aaron Sorkin-y, like all these characters speak in the same way, and like no one's really an individual, they're all just kind of these avatars for this story and this kind of dialogue. Mm-hmm. But it's so good that you kind of like you understand a criticism of it, and that there's no naturalism involved, but overall it manages to do so much with that style that it's, you know, you can easily overlook it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's true. That's not just true of Sorkin. It's true of any writer with a distinctive sort of ability to write dialogue, you know, and I'll take it 10 times out of 10, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I saw McDonough, he's an Irish playwright, I think we mentioned, that this was compared to Southern American with an Irish attitude. Like, it's the stubbornness and the wit and the, you know, alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And that it does, it's kind of these merging of these two tones that ends up working together pretty well.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So you did like this movie a lot, right?
Yes. Okay. I did. My problems with this movie are basically like filmmaking related. I just think it's kind of like when I found out this movie and In Bruges had the exact same budget, I was blown away, because In Bruges is a movie that is also written and directed by Martin McDonagh, which I also like a lot, but just is so much more elegantly made. And I don't even know if the difference is just that, because so many of the elements are the same. The style of writing I like similarly in both movies. The acting I like similarly in both movies. I think it's just like as small as In Bruges was shot on film, and it was a cheap movie shot on film, and this is a cheap movie shot on digital. And it just, there's just like a, I don't know, there's something just so haphazard about the cinematography in this movie to me, that it just looks, the movie deserves better than the cinematography that it got. And it just bums me out. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I hadn't noticed, but again, this is something that it's too down the middle. Like, it's not, it's just like artistically done, or what?
Like, there are some moments that are nice and artistic, and like some good, I think the scene when Woody Harrelson is reading his suicide note, like the first of the three notes that we hear him read in the movie. I mean, I hate his performance of how he reads them. That's like the one acting moment that I don't like.
Okay.
Because it sounds like, just to, while we're on the subject, it sounds like he's reading those notes as opposed to writing those notes. And when you're writing something, that is not the way that you hear it in your head. When you're writing something, and fucking Martin McDonagh should know it. when you're writing something, it's like a confident stream of, this is my thought, especially something like that he would have put so much thought into. It's like, this is what I'm thinking as I type it. You know, it would flow more smoothly than it sounds like Woody Harrelson is reading those lines for the first time. And I just think that choice was such a mistake. Okay. But I will say, I think that sequence is beautiful. Like, the editing in that sequence is really beautiful. It's just sort of the standard. You really have to try hard to make some cinematography look good. And I just think that with the potential limitations that they had on this movie, maybe time, just inability to light scenes perfectly and all that stuff, it just looks very flat in the way that I often complain about digital cinematography, where there's just, it feels like there's more of a depth in In Bruges. And just to make sure that I was right, I watched like 10 minutes of In Bruges the other day and I was like, yeah, I'm right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But you like Woody Harrelson overall in this?
Yeah. Yes, I do. It still kind of bums me out that his wife is 20 years younger than him. But other than that,
keeps happening to him, eh?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I certainly like Woody Harrelson in pretty much every movie. And I think the, I think if we're looking at isolated moments in this movie that are among my favorites, despite the criticism I just gave of Woody Harrelson's performance, I think the moment when he kills himself and the reading of that note, I think that's the most, some of the most beautiful stuff in the movie.
Yeah,
it's not a movie that goes for beauty very frequently, but I do find that moment really beautiful, and I just think the way that note is written is very, very beautiful.
Yeah, it's the one that gets the biggest chance too, right?
Yeah.
Like, there are moments of anger, and there's moments of sad, like, as you know, the flashback moment we discussed, Dixon taking on Red in a very one-sided fight.
That's a good moment of cinematography. Like, it still looks kind of plasticky, but the camera work is fantastic.
Yeah, no, I think that's what I mean. Like, these are some of the sequences that I think get the best chance to kind of go for your heart, and yeah, you know, in a variety, like from a variety of directions, like seeking different visceral reactions. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a few more, but I guess Dixon at the bar, trying to get the DNA. You know, these moments.
That's a really good sequence too, actually.
Yeah, no, that's what I like. These are the ones that I would put, you know, in the pantheon for movies. Like moments in this that get a good chance to affect you.
Yeah, the use of music in both the Red sequence and that bar sequence is really good too.
Yeah, but I do think that. I mean, it's probably the longest one, and we've just spent a good portion of time with him and his family and his young daughters. So it, you know, it has the, like, just on paper, it has the, a recipe to get an emotional response from you, but mm-hmm. I think it's done fantastically. Like, I think that there's a way that can be so cheap and exploitative. And I just thought that was really emotionally affecting.
Yeah. And I mean, it doesn't, it also is just surprising, you know. I think that's sort of,
yeah,
it just is teed up so perfectly. As you said, like, you get all that time with him and his family, but it's also just something you didn't anticipate happening, you know, both from the fact that it's Woody Harrelson. So you expect, when you see Woody Harrelson is in a movie, especially the way he's established at the beginning of the movie, you expect him to be around, even though you know that he is dying. Yeah.
You even expect him to die during this movie, at least, but
yeah,
just not in that manner.
Yeah, either during this movie or shortly after, if you, depending on how long you think this story is going to take to play out. But yeah, nobody seems to expect that coming, and just the way that it is handled is very nice. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Completely. Mm-hmm. And that's really strong. And yeah, I kind of just thought, like, there's a few moments in this where early on, that cancer moment, where he reveals to Mildred that he does have cancer. Mm-hmm. I didn't know a ton about this movie going into it. My lead up was like, Francis and Sam Rockwell are really good in this, and I know you know that already, but it's better than you expect it to be. Like, mm-hmm. those are not people who we expect to kind of have bad performances, really. And so I didn't know much about the cast other than those two, and I didn't know much about the story. And I think one of my criticisms when we talked about Manchester by the Sea, that it's just so much. Like, it's when he tries to kill himself in the police station, and, you know, he burns down his house by accident when he's high and drunk. And, like, it's just, it's so much that it's almost like a comedy at a point, that it's so much.
Yeah.
I kind of predicted him saying he was going to have cancer, and I thought that this was just going to be like just super downbeat the whole time, and that it kind of gets overwhelming, and it gets abstract in its sadness, and it kind of loses its effect. And not that this movie is lacking in sadness at all, but I was so happy that her response was what it was. You know, it just made it that much more dynamic and that much more interesting, that it wasn't just going to be a total downer. And yeah, I know this is not a light movie in any means, but I think you can see the distinction I'm trying to make there.
Yeah, it's not a light movie, but it's something that you know, fluctuates in tone, whereas Manchester by the Sea was almost like one of those older Alejandro Gonzalez Iñárritu movies where it's just like every scene is progressively sadder than the one that came before it. You know, it's just this slow progression into just constant sadness. And Manchester by the Sea isn't quite like, say, Iñárritu's Beautiful, I think, which is 2011 or something like that. Like, that movie is terrible exclusively because every scene is like, this is more depressing than what you just saw, and this is more depressing than, like, if you want to see what you're describing with the Manchester by the Sea effect pushed to way beyond its logical limit, that's the movie for you.
Okay,
you will hate it.
And we get Lucas Hedges doing the exact same thing in this movie.
Yeah.
Or sorry, Fruit Loop Boy. And the other thing I like about it, not only did it avoid that, but I did enjoy, as I've kind of touched on a few times, that things happen and we learn things and things still surprise us, like Willoughby's suicide, learning Charlie was the one who burnt down the billboards, when you kind of forget that you're wondering who did it anymore. And so that reveal kind of has an extra punch to me.
I just kind of assumed Dixon did it with the billboards. I think that's what they want you to think, you know, like he's going out somewhere.
I think that's the red herring that makes Charlie's reveal even more effective.
Mm-hmm.
I do like that things actually happen in this movie, and it's not just as much as it is predicated on this, you know, the billboards, which start so early, and obviously the crime that's committed that sets all this in motion. Like, it's still very propulsive, and I think it keeps moving, and that, and I think deftly handling a transition from super heavy to extremely funny, because this movie is very, very funny at points. Is how this ended up with me liking it as much as I did.
when Lucas Hedges says it was a gag after he calls his mom the C word, it's so funny. It was a gag. Like, I mean, there are a million instances of that, but that was especially even by this movie standards, because it's just sort of a moment of it's a moment of humor, but also one where, like, a character realizes that even within this world where people say some of the things that are said in this movie, it's like, you don't call your mom that, you know?
Completely.
Well,
and one last thing on Willoughby is just that I kind of, again, with kind of trying to predict what I was getting into, and Woody does what Woody has been doing now, and that becomes clear pretty quickly that he's playing this character that, I mean, I haven't seen everything he's done lately, but for the most part, this is what he does now. Like, it's his wheelhouse / pigeonhole, I think, at this point.
Well, it's the wheelhouse of things that you actually see. Like, you didn't see the LBJ biopic, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. That's what I was saying. I kind of expected to be over it a bit more. Like, I just thought it would be a bit more stale at this point. And, I mean, I'm happy to see him do something else, but I was a bit more pleasantly surprised than I thought I would be.
Yeah, it's never bad when Woody Harrelson's in your movie.
No, he's funny.
Yeah, he's funny, and he's like a, I don't know, I think as a presence, he's very good. Like, I mean, he, even in dramatic roles that he has, he's never really like a big actor, but like, and I mean big like performative sort of thing, but he just sort of has a I don't know, a presence where he just always feels comfortable in front of a camera. I mean, he's been in front of cameras forever, you know, since he was very, very young. Like, that's just been his life. But even beyond the fact that this has been his profession pretty much since before he became an adult, I don't know, there is just a calm presence about him where he's just comfortable sitting wherever he is, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe because he's high, but who knows? But yeah, and I do think he is perfect for a character like Willoughby, who preaches things like calm, you know, and just being calm and patient, you know? And that's what so much of his note to Dixon is about. Going back to the discussion of humor in this movie and the way that this movie jumps between tones in a smooth smooth way. I think one of the most positive things I can say about this movie is that the boiled down message of this movie is said out loud in this movie, but it is also like coded in jokes when it's said. It's the anger begets anger conversation. And that might be one of the funniest scenes in the movie. And then you just are sitting there watching it. And I mean, pretty soon after that, once you see Mildred put down the wine, you also get the orange juice sequence in the hospital. And then towards the end of the movie, you just sort of realize that that is the idea that this movie wants you to think about. And that it is placed in such a funny sequence is really impressive, you know. And it exactly, like, my favorite things in movies are when you do something that I say that I hate, but you make me like it. And one of the things I hate when movies do is tell me exactly what they want me to think about it, and that's what they do in this movie. And I still, like, I love that scene, I love the idea, and I love the way that the movie plays with that phrase going forward.
Yeah, sprinkle a little bit of Zoo Girl on top of that very, very clear point being forced down your throat.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Throw in some polio jokes and I'm there.
Yeah, I think for very little screen time, that woman does her job very well.
She is so good in this movie. She is fantastic. Like, weirdly, all the female bit parts in this movie are played perfectly. You know, like, she's fantastic. Denise is fantastic. The woman who works with Red is so good. And they all just have very little to do, you know?
Yeah.
All fantastic.
Do we get a reason why Dixon's just not, like, in jail for what he does?
When, which, sorry, which time?
No, I guess the what he gets fired for.
No.
Which is like assault with a deadly weapon.
Yeah. And... Oh, I mean, I think you could qualify that as attempted murder. He throws him out a window, you know?
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I don't think it doesn't take a very talented lawyer to decide, hey, we can probably win this one.
Okay. Yeah, I was looking over my notes and I was wondering if I missed a line about, like, they don't press charges because of blank or something.
I would say small town sort of self-policing sort of thing, yeah. Which I don't think is necessarily right. And I think we don't anticipate Dixon would kill anybody. But as an outsider in that town, you should be aware of this and, like, be terrified of this person.
Yeah.
Especially since he has a history of violence that seemingly everybody knows about. But I'm chalking it up to small towns hoping that the person that they have known for their entire life can sort of get a shit together.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and since you brought it up, this this idea of Dixon's history, you know, I think I said it a bit before that we kind of watch his redemption during this, and it's a very unique form of redemption that we get to see him do, but mm-hmm. I think it's pretty effective in that way. So, we get the sense that he is involved in, well, not the sense, but it's stated pretty clearly that he had some kind of racially, maybe not motivated, but very likely motivated, some racially related violence in his past, right?
Yes.
And that's, you know, the man putting up the billboard says that to him, and then he gets a few more mentions. And what do you make of the kind of the role that violence against, like, the black community plays into this? Is that just the signifier that he's a bad person? And, you know, when he's talking about and correcting between persons of color and black or African American, is that him trying to, like, really trying to function a bit more, or is that just him saying something he's heard? Like, I just didn't know if you had an idea about that whole thread, because it kind of weaves in and out of the story. Like, it bobs its head up once in a while, but it's definitely not something that is driven home. Like, it doesn't feel like a central theme to this movie, even though it kind of pops up every 20 minutes.
Yeah, I think what we are supposed to watch with Dixon is, like, Mildred doesn't change all that much throughout the movie. Dixon changes a lot.
Yeah.
And I think what we are supposed to see is this real transition that Dixon goes through from being the dumb idiot to sort of being like the calm Willoughby type at the end of the movie. Like, and I mean, he doesn't by the end of the movie, but the idea is that maybe he's starting to listen to those lessons. And I do think the orange juice with the straw has a pretty big effect on him, at least in this story. And I think we are also supposed to see his sort of transition between between mothers. Like his mother is racist, like unapologetically so. And Mildred is just less racist. You know, like it's not like there's also a hugely difficult relationship that Dixon seems to have with his mom. They argue and stuff, but it also does seem like a loving relationship in some capacity, and that she tries to help him when he comes home just covered in blood. But I do think there is supposed to be sort of some transition between the type of woman he's willing to drive to Idaho with, you know, throughout the movie. And he says change is slow in the South. I think we're supposed to view that as something that's happening slowly and over time.
And something true of him, maybe, right?
Something true of him. I think it's also commentary, just as a quick note, just commentary on police violence against minorities. And also, the one thing that really makes me think about this is that his mother has a pet. The pet is a turtle or a tortoise, and tortoises move slow, just like change in the South. And
yeah.
I think we're supposed to view that as it might take a generation, but change can happen. And I think as long as Dixon is willing to become more calm and sort of, as Willoughby has suggested, and sort of realize that he is in an environment that anger begets anger, racism begets racism. If he's able to get out from that and at least, you know, sort of start to hang out with other people who aren't casually racist all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that can lead to some sort of change, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we do see him. It's funny that kind of one of his, he's kind of too, heroic moments in this, right? I mean, it's him taking the time to take the Angela Hayes file and put it under his shirt and then run through the fire with it. And, you know, he takes that extra bit of time, which is endangering his life every millisecond that he lets pass, but, you know, takes a breath and does something, considers somebody else's future, not just his, and ends up doing something pretty selfless. And then we also see him at the bar with the person he believes at the time to probably be Angela's rapist. It's still a very Dixon thing to do, is just be a drunk asshole and get in a fight. But he takes that moment to check the license plate. He makes a plan about, instead of just punching the guy, to be able to get some DNA off the guy. In that scene especially, he's still very much being Dixon, right? Like, he's doing something so in his wheelhouse, but it's just the one more breath and one more bit of planning that it takes to make this not just a moment that you believe you did something right, but something comes from it, right? Like, more dominoes can fall. You have this evidence. It ends up being fruitless, but there's this character growth where he has something to show for his actions, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And he also apologizes to Red in the hospital as well, which is a moment worth noting.
Yeah. No, it's nice. Mm-hmm. And as just one more thing, I think about making this sort of timely about race relations, particularly in the South, and police violence. Like, this movie, I was very pleasantly surprised by how much I liked this movie, and I was expecting to like it a lot. It just felt like one of the previews for this movie was Isle of Dogs, which Wes Anderson's like stop motion one, which I'm very excited to see because I love everything he's made. But this was really just like, it was very reaffirming about movies for me. Like, I really, really liked this. And it, you know, just because we talked about Injustice for All recently, like, that was a movie that I had some good messages, and it didn't come together for me. Like, it felt a bit disjointed, even though it was good, it just wasn't like kind of a complete vision to me. And then with Isle of Dogs, I was excited about seeing it, but I didn't know, like, it's just not my world. I don't know what I could get from it other than a fun time at the movies. But even though you've said this doesn't feel like the real world, and it certainly doesn't, like, there is kind of this cartoonish element to it, it still kind of feels like my world a little bit. Like, it's sex crimes and racism and a tons of good performances. Like, no, as bad as that is.
The way that you said it, it kind of is my world, sex crimes and racism.
Oh, yeah.
You
know? No, it's this world, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Like, it did feel like a movie that, like, the fact that it had to take some time to get made and, you know, was at TIFF already this year, so we're kind of backwards looking, like, it just did feel like a movie that is very still like worldly and immediate and appropriate for right now.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I did talk a lot of shit about the direction of the movie or the cinematography of the movie. But it does sort of, when the movie ends, it does still have a hold over you as you're leaving the movie, you know? And I mean, I've talked about this on a lot of different podcasts. Like, I think that's the most impressive thing. The most impressive thing a movie can do is like, if I see it alone, I don't immediately put my headphones on as I'm walking out of the theater, you know? I still just want to like, I want to at least walk to the subway or walk home just still thinking about this movie and still being within this hold, the hold of this movie. And I also specifically remember that happening with In Bruges and, you know, countless other movies that I like a lot. And it's always just the biggest compliment is that it's just this totally imperceptible feeling that you've been in this world for an hour and 55 minutes or however long this movie is. And when the filmmakers decide it's time to let you go, they still haven't really let you go, you know, like you're still willing to deal with their thought processes as you are walking home, you know? And I just think that's, that is the most impressive thing that a movie can do. Even if I don't necessarily know why. Hail Caesar is another podcast where I've talked about that feeling where it's just like, I didn't figure the movie out before it ended. I figured it out on the walk home, and that sort of just changes how you feel about it. But even just like wanting to sort of just have that tone just sort of stay in your head, you know, it's just a really impressive thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of having an effect after something's done, the Willoughby's letter to Mildred when he talks about, again, another good reveal and like another kind of X's and O's plot point thing is that he's the one paying for the billboards. Yeah. And it's kind of just to fuck with her.
Yeah, it's great.
And that he keeps, she keeps his name up on the third one. Like, you could have the same message by taking the third one down and everyone knows he's dead. So it would be kind of respectful and maybe get a bit of the people in the town who really dislike you at this moment to get on your side a little bit. And I think it's just like this like little devilish move by both of them to keep it going that way.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think it's good because it also illustrates where Mildred is. I mean, I think she says, no, we'll put it back up. He's paying for it, you know, like we might as well. I think that also illustrates the fact that she's still at a point where she's very stubborn and she refuses to change. She has this mission in her head. She's like, I'm doing this. This is happening. I'm going to do anything, including, again, Molotov cocktailing a police station to make this happen. And I think a lot of Willoughby's purpose in this movie is to sort of show that some things, no matter how sad they are, like some things are just have just happened and you have to accept them. And you just have to sort of try your best to sort of reach a level of calm, despite knowing that these events have either happened or are going to happen. You know, that's what him, I think his suicide is meant to indicate. It's meant to show that he is somebody that knows something horrible is happening to him. So it's a slow progressive sort of thing. Yeah. And he knows it's going to happen. He's sort of let it go and he's trying to make his peace with it. And the way that he can do that is having the most perfect day of his life before he kills himself. And that's what his letters are trying to preach to Dixon and Mildred in some capacity. And I think that's sort of the place that we get to with Mildred is that we're watching her not being able to let something go. And she'll never truly be able to let that go. I'm not saying like, forget about your daughter, you know, that's bonkers. But just in a way that this crime may never be solved and you just sort of have to come to terms with the fact that something like unbelievably tragic has happened to you and your daughter and your family, but life will continue to go on regardless, you know. And I just think that's a really good thing to put in this movie about so many sad, depressing things. And I think it also again, Woody Harrelson's the perfect person to play a character that is meant to stand for these types of things just because he seems so calm and all that. And I just think that's a good idea behind the suicide of Willoughby as the movie progresses and you start to think about it, you know?
Yeah, he controls what he can. Like he says, he kind of has like this one perfect day and he knows after this he's going to lose control of his body, and he's going to be able to lose control of his life, and his wife is going to be forced to, you know, rearrange her schedule and stand by him and do everything that she has to do as, like, he kind of, as his life sort of closes out, and he, you know, he really cuts his losses in a way and says, like, I had this great day with you guys, and that's, this is how I want to be remembered, and that's why he goes out the way he does when he does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And just speaking of calm, and this is a subject that sometimes you beat me to, so I'll ask you about it this time, is the media. It's, as we said, like, this stuff happens because she puts these billboards up, and the reason I think she chooses these ones is because they're so cheap, because nobody sees them. And you just get this idea that without a couple news reports, without probably one news report by a local affiliate, this action doesn't have the same impact. Like, these dominoes don't really fall over, or at least this many of them, without that. And I want to know, like, what if you saw a specific media angle in here, and if we're going to talk about a movie about the world we're in today, this outrage culture, and like, is this a story, is this new story within the movie kind of just to stoke any ratings by, you know, like, getting people kind of furious about something, or is it like a proper story, or did you see an angle in here?
No, I didn't really view the media from any sort of perspective other than comedy. And also, in a town of that size, I mean, I presumably that television station is not just for
ebbing.
Yeah, exactly. It's for the area. And in those sorts of areas, like, I mean, I'm from a city, and every time I go back to a city of population of like 350,000, but even when I go visit and watch the local news, like, it's baffling the small scale stories they'll cover, just because not enough happens in the city to fill half an hour of news every day. And I can only imagine that problem exists tenfold in a place like Ebbing. And, and I think they're just covering it because it's something. I sort of view it as, the only sort of meaning that I saw within it was that the reason those billboards don't get seen anymore is because nobody uses that road anymore since the freeway came in. And I think freeway/media is just sort of a progression of modernity in this town, and that people now still see these billboards if they're inflammatory enough, because the media will go there, but they won't drive past them, you know, because there's just a better way to avoid it now, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
they don't have to be in the same physical space, but because they know one or two things happen per day in Ebbing, and so, yeah.
Okay.
The news will alert them to anything that happens.
Okay. Yeah, just media and alcohol and visuals are like your trifecta of things for Alex to talk about.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so exactly.
You had an angle.
Although
here,
now that you've brought up the media, I'm curious to know how would that television station, like, what are their newsroom meetings like during this time period when all of these things are happening that are just like
the Molotov cocktailing of,
well,
the,
yeah, exactly. You've got
those story,
those billboards that are worth covering. You've got you've got Red throwing being thrown out a window in downtown across the street from a police station by a police officer who is only fired and not arrested afterwards. You've got the Molotov cocktails. I don't know. I feel like there's probably something else. You've got the billboards being put back up in the night after they've burnt down.
And set on fire. Yeah.
Like, they're just, the producers and the talent are probably just sitting around being like, what the fuck are we, like, how do we cover this? We're used to covering, like, dogs being taken out of trees or whatever, you know? So.
Yeah. And anyway, women are driving by and yelling slurs at our reporters too.
Yeah, exactly.
Really talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Tough times being a media personality in Ebbing.
I guess so.
Yeah. Is Ebbing a real place? Did you look into this?
No, I didn't look.
Okay. It just seemed like something you would look into that I wouldn't, but I was just curious.
Yeah. Do you think this movie's different if that happened to be Dixon's, or Dixon happened to find that guy was the Angela's rapist? Is that like a coincidence you dislike, or because they mentioned, like, all right, I think it's Willoughby says this this is how these things shake down sometimes. You know, it's someone brags about it in a jail cell or at a bar, and that's the break, right? Like, you can't find it.
I mean, I think it totally changes the movie because it wouldn't answer on a question. Like, I mean, I guess it would answer on a sort of question, do they still commit murder? But I certainly like the movie better this way, especially since, again, as we've talked about, if a movie is pointing me in one direction and I'm just like, oh, yeah, of course it makes sense that this guy did it, in the information that this movie has given us, that they then sort of turn against that. That type of thing just always works for me, you know?
Yeah, it's
always better than me being right about what I anticipated.
Right. Yes, I get you.
And yes, I think it would change the tone of the movie, and I think it's sort of it adds an extra layer to the whole question of will Mildred be able to, and again, let this go in a sort of way that, like, just let her anger go, anger at the police force go, like the anger at the crime should be there forever, but just to sort of try to have her own life again, you know?
Yeah,
like it adds an extra layer to that question about her life.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that this movie's so unpredictable in those ways of how these dominoes actually fall. I mean, there's things that just absolutely, as we both mentioned, surprise us, and just some plot progressions that are sort of out of the blue. And I think that him just overhearing it would build into that sense of chaos, and that, you know, you can't control everything, you control what you can, but some things just happen and some things take time, right? This wasn't the case that Willoughby or any police officer working 24 hours a day could have solved, right? If that's how that information got out, there's no amount of police work. It just took a little bit of time. And I think that the idea of the passage of time is one that comes into a story about grief. So it would kind of play into that there was just a certain amount of time needed to pass, but then it's even more chaotic that happens and nothing comes of it, right? Or you chase it down to Idaho or whatever state that guy was from, and there's just that next chaotic domino falling, and you can't predict what's going to happen after that as well.
Yeah, it also just sort of expands the story. Like, it's just like, we have no doubts that this person is terrible, like a terrible human being, and it just sort of magnifies what happened to Angela exists outside of Ebbing as well. You know, like it is a worldwide problem. It is not a small town problem, you know? And I think that is the probably the main thing about it that, that I like about that decision, is that, it's like, these predators are not just in Ebbing, you know?
Yeah. The fact that he's describing this crime that, Dixon overhears, and it's like, all the details are right about this, but it just happens so often that the details can be right, and it's a different case.
It's not the specific instance.
Anything else about Three Billboards?
Carter Burwell is the secret MVP of this movie, because Carter Burwell is the secret MVP of most movies that he scores. And I just feel like
sure how you'd feel about that one.
Oh, Carter Burwell's the best.
Yeah, I can't speak to his career. I just didn't know if the music would be something you enjoyed.
No, the music's perfect. And I think that's that description I gave earlier of this movie sort of having a hold on you even as you leave the theater. I think a big part of that is just the music, like the pensive sort of feel of the music, which is Carter Burwell sort of staple, like nothing ever moves all that quickly. And he is just so good at making scores for thoughtful, dark movies. And I mean, there's a reason the Coen brothers go to him for everything whenever they can. And he's just like, he is a composer that, like, people like us know about. We know his name and we know he's fantastic, but somehow he's not viewed as sort of a part of the upper echelon of composers. And I just think he's so unbelievably talented, and so many of the movies that he has scored are better because of him. I also think this movie is a very Coen-y sort of movie. Even if Francis McDormand wasn't married to a Coen brother or the lead of one of their most famous movies, like, it would feel very Coen brother-y.
And her most famous movie, right?
Well, yeah, that's true. That too. And I don't know. I just think that the tone of music he is able to create just works perfectly with the tone of movie that this is. But that's not to say he's not versatile, because he's done Spike Jonze movies, I think everyone but her, and the scores for that are great. And it's just, I don't know, there's just something about him that I think is so deeply underrated, despite the fact that we all accept that he's good. And Carter Burwell, you know, he's great.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I think we've probably touched on everybody. Well, not everybody, but in bits and pieces, but an all-star cast too, right? Like, even Peter Dinklage, we haven't mentioned, who is wonderful in this. And
yeah, of course, because find me a movie Peter Dinklage isn't wonderful in.
Well, I know, but that's what I'm saying.
Best of luck.
You lose people in this because of how good, like you said, some of those female bit parts too, right? There's just give them a few lines and it's done well. And I think that I'm not going to be the first or last person to say it, but a lot of the strength of this movie comes from excellent performances.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you look in McDonough's career, just like you look at a lot of people that write in a very specific way, sort of career, that then have control over the casting of their words, of the people that will say their words. And it's just, I think you just sort of get to a point where you found somebody that can speak the way that you want to speak, you know, or you want your characters to speak. So you will cast them as frequently as you can, you know, like Sam Rockwell, Woody Harrelson, Abby Cornish have all been in a Martin McDonagh movie before this one, just like in the last movie, Colin Farrell had been in Martin McDonagh's previous work. And I think it just sort of, for somebody like McDonagh, who's probably so precious about the words that he writes, just because, you know, he's a writer first and a director second, and he says as much in interviews. He doesn't really think about the visuals while he's writing. He only thinks about the words. You would just want to make sure you have people that can say the words properly, you know, and also from the actor's perspective, these are words that actors want to say. You know, these are movies that people want to be a part of. This is why Peter Dinklage would be in a role that has as little screen time as it does in this movie. And same with John Hawkes, even though John Hawkes is the type of person that could conceivably be in this movie, no matter who wrote it in that same role. But like we all know John Hawkes is overqualified for most of the roles that he plays. But it's just bound down in this. Sorry?
He's bounded down in this.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. And I just think it's a benefit for both the writer and the actor, in that the writer wants his words to be said in the exact way that he wants them to be said. Yeah. And the actor is just jumping at the chance to be able to say these words that way, you know?
Yeah, when you can be like an awful badass, but still have people cheer and clap for like and laugh at your dialogue. That's
yeah. And people like, right? People vocally react to this movie, which is cool.
Yeah.
It does not happen.
Yeah, I was in a less than half full theater, but it felt like a full crowd just because of, very vocal reactions.
Yeah. Like, oh no, as Willoughby kills himself. Like, I heard somebody literally say, oh no. It was something else.
Oh boy. Yeah.
And that's like one of 100 examples. And normally a loud theater is annoying, but this is the good kind of loud theater. And another high compliment that could be paid to this movie is that you can create the good kind of loud theater. Yeah.
Yeah. And the visceral reactions that come from a properly felt world, right?
Yeah, exactly. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week. We'll be talking about something else.